But then, why not? Classes were over for the day. The second-year students were allowed off campus. There was no reason not to go out with Isabel immediately. Except that he'd had no time to prepare, no time to come up with a game plan, no time to obsess over his hair and his casually rumpled look, no time to brainstorm a list of discussion topics in case conversation flagged. But then, none of those things had saved their previous three dates from disaster. Maybe it was time to experiment with spontaneity. Especially since it didn't seem like Isabel was giving him much of a choice. "Now it is," Simon agreed. "Should we invite Helen?" "On our date?" Idiot. He gave himself a mental slap upside the head. "Helen, you want to crash our romantic date?" Isabel called. Helen emerged from the bedroom. "Nothing I would love more than being an awkward third wheel," she said. "But I am not actually allowed to leave." "Excuse me?" Isabel's fingers played at the electrum whip wrapped around her left wrist. Simon couldn't blame her for wanting to strike something, or someone. "Please tell me you're kidding." "Katarina laid out a circle of protection around the cabin," Helen said. "It won't stop you from coming and going, but I'm told it will be rather effective if I try to leave before I'm summoned."
"Katarina wouldn't do that,"
Simon protested, but Helen put out a hand to quiet him. "They didn't give her much of a choice," Helen said, "and I asked her to just go along. It was part of the deal."
"That is unacceptable," Isabel said with barely concealed fury. "Forget the date. We're staying here with you."
She was lit up with a beautiful glow of righteous rage, and Simon wanted suddenly, desperately, to sweep her in his arms and kiss her until the end of the world. "You will most certainly not forget the date," Helen said. "You're not staying here a single second longer. No argument." There was, in fact, plenty more argument, but Helen finally convinced them that being stuck there with them, knowing she'd ruined their day, would be even worse than being stuck there alone.
"Now please, and I say this with love, get the hell out."
She gave Izzy a hug and then embraced Simon in turn.
"Don't screw this up," she whispered in his ear, then pushed them both out the door and closed it behind them.
There were two white horses neighing by the front path, as if they were waiting for Isabel. Simon supposed they were. Animals in Idris behaved differently from how they did back home, almost as if they could understand what their humans wanted, and, if you asked nicely enough, were willing to deliver.
"So, where exactly are we going on this date?" Simon asked.
It hadn't occurred to him that they would ride into Alicante, but of course, this was Idris. No cars, no trains, nothing but medieval or magical transportation. And he supposed a horse was better than a vampire motorcycle. Marginally. Isabel grinned and swung herself up onto the saddle as easily as if she were mounting a bike. Simon, on the other hand, clumsily heaved himself onto his horse with enough grunting and sweating that he was afraid she'd take one look and call the whole thing off.
"We're going shopping," Isabel informed him. "It's time you get yourself a sword."
"It doesn't actually have to be a sword," Isabel said, as they stepped into Diana's Arrow. The ride to Alicante had been like something out of a dream, or at least a cheesy romance novel. The two of them astride white stallions galloping across the countryside, charging across emerald meadows and through a forest the color of flames. Isabel's hair streamed behind her like a river of ink, and Simon had even managed not to fall off his horse, never a foregone conclusion. Best of all, between the rush of wind and the thunder of hoofbeats, it had been too loud for conversation. In motion, things felt easy between them, natural. Simon could almost forget that this was one of the most important moments of his life, and anything he said or did could screw it up forever. Now, back at ground level, the weight settled back on his shoulders. It was hard to think of anything clever to say with his brain echoing the same four words over and over again. "Don't screw this up."
"They have everything here," Izzy continued, presumably trying to fill the dull silence Simon's nerves left in their wake. "Daggers, axes, throwing stars, oh, and bows, of course. All kinds of bows. It's awesome."
"Yeah," Simon said weakly. "Awesome." He had, in his year at the academy, learned to fight almost as well as any beginning shadow hunter, and had a proficiency with every weapon she'd named. But he discovered that knowing how to use a weapon was very different from wanting to.
In his pre-Shadowhunter life, Simon had delivered many passionate rants on the subject of gun control, and would have loved nothing more than for every weapon in the city to be dumped into the East River. Not that a gun was the same as a sword, and not that he didn't love the feeling of unleashing an arrow from his bow and watching it fly swiftly and surely into the heart of his target. But the way Isabel loved her whip, the way Clary talked about her sword like it was a member of the family, the Shadowhunter passion for deadly weapons still took some getting used to. Diana's Arrow, a weapons shop on Flintlock Street at the heart of Alicante, was full of more deadly objects than Simon had ever seen in one place, and that included the Academy weapons room, which could have supplied an army. But while the Academy arsenal was more like a storage closet, swords and daggers and arrows piled in haphazard stacks and crowded onto dangerously rickety shelves, Diana's Arrow reminded Simon of a fancy jewelry store. The weapons were on proud display, shining blades fanned across velvet cases, the better to show off their metallic gleam.
"So what kind of thing are you looking for?"
The guy behind the counter had a spiky mohawk and a faded arcade fire t-shirt and looked more suited to a comic book counter than this one. Simon assumed this probably wasn't Diana. "How about a bow?" Izzy said. "Something really spectacular, fit for a champion." "Maybe not that spectacular," Simon said quickly. "Maybe something a little more unobtrusive." "People often underestimate the importance of good battle style," Isabel said. "You want to intimidate the enemy before you even make a move."
"You don't think my intimidating wardrobe will do the job there?"
Simon gestured at his own t-shirt, which featured an anime cat spewing green puke. Isabel gave him what sounded like a pity laugh, then turned back to not Diana. "What have you got in daggers?" she asked. "Anything gold-plated?"
"I'm not really a gold-plated kind of guy," Simon said, "or a dagger kind of guy."
"We have some nice swords," the guy said. "You do look hot with the sword," Isabel said, "as I recall."
"Maybe?"
Simon tried to sound encouraging, but she must have heard the skepticism in his voice. She turned on him. "It's like you don't even want a weapon."
"Well,
so what are we doing here?" Isabel snapped.
"You suggested it?"
Isabel looked like she wanted to stomp her foot or stomp his face.
"Excuse me for trying to help you behave like a respectable shadow hunter. Forget it. We can go."
"No," he said quickly. "That's not what I meant."
With Isabel, it was never what he meant. Simon had always considered himself a man of words, as opposed to a man of deeds. Or of swords, for that matter.
His mother liked to say he could talk her into almost anything. All he could do with Isabel, it seemed, was talk himself out of a girlfriend.
I'll just give the two of you some space to look around," the shopkeeper said, backing quickly away from the awkward. He disappeared into the back.
"I'm sorry," Simon said. "Let's stay, please. Of course I want your help picking something out." She sighed.
"No, I'm sorry. Choosing your first weapon is a really personal thing. I get it. Take your time, look around. I'll shut up."
"I don't want you to shut up," he said. But she shook her head and zipped her lips shut, then raised three fingers in the air, scout's honor, which didn't seem like a shadow hunter thing, and Simon wondered who had taught her to do that. He wondered if it had been him. Sometimes he hated before Simon and all the things he'd shared with Isabel, things today Simon could never understand. It was weird and headache-inducing, competing with yourself. They browsed the store, taking in the options. Pole arms, athames, serif blades, elaborately carved crossbows, chakrams, throwing knives, a full display case of golden whips over which Isabel nearly began to drool. The silence was oppressive. Simon had never had a good date, at least not that he could recall. But he was pretty sure they tended to involve some talking. "Poor Helen," he said, testing the heft and balance of a medieval-looking broadsword. At least this was one subject they were sure to agree on. "I hate what they're doing to her," Isabel said. She was stroking a deadly-looking silver kindle as if it were a puppy. "How was it in class? Was it as bad as I imagined?"
"Worse," Simon admitted.
The look on her face when she was telling the story of her parents. Isabel's grip tightened around the kindle. Why can't they see how hideous it is to treat her like this? She's not a fairy.
Well, that's not really the point, is it? Isabel laid the kinjal down carefully in its velvet case.
What do you mean?
Whether or not she's a fairy, it's beside the point. She fixed Simon with a fiery gaze.
Helen Blackthorne is a shadow hunter, she spit out. Mark Blackthorne is a shadow hunter. If we can't agree on that, we have a problem.
Of course we agree on that.
It made him love her all the more, seeing how angry she got on behalf of her friends. Why couldn't he just say that to her? Why was everything so hard?
They're as much shadow hunters as you are. I just mean that even if they weren't, if we were talking about some actual fairy, it still wouldn't be right to treat her like she's the enemy because of what she was, right?
Well, Simon was astonished.
What do you mean, well?
I mean that maybe any fairy is potentially an enemy, Simon. Look what they did to us. Look how much misery they caused.
They didn't all cause that misery, but they're all paying for it.
Isabel sighed. Look, I don't like the cold piece any more than you do. And you're right. Not all fairies are the enemy, obviously. Not all of them betrayed us, and it's not fair that they should all be punished for that.
You think I don't know that?
Good, Simon said.
But...
I really don't see how there can be a but, Simon cut in.
But it's not as simple as you're trying to make it. The Seelie Queen did betray us. A legion of fairies did join Sebastian in the Dark War. A lot of good shadow hunters got killed. You've got to see why that would leave people angry and afraid.
Stop talking, Simon told himself. His mother had once told him you should never discuss religion or politics on a date. He was never quite sure which one of those categories Clave policies fell into, but either way, this was like trying to defend J.J. Abrams to a hardcore Trekkie. Hopeless. But, inexplicably, and despite the sincere wishes of his brain, Simon's mouth kept moving.
I don't care how angry or scared you get. It's not right to punish all the fairies for a few fairies' mistakes, or to discriminate against people.
I'm not saying anyone should discriminate.
Actually, that's exactly what you're saying.
Oh, great, Simon. So the Seelie Queen and her minions screw us over and enable the death of hundreds of shadow hunters, not to mention the ones they slaughtered themselves, and I'm the terrible person?
I didn't say you were a terrible person.
You're thinking it, she said. Would you stop telling me what I think? He barked, more harshly than he'd intended.
Her mouth snapped shut. She took a deep breath. He counted to 10. Each waited the other out. When Isabel spoke again, she sounded calmer, but also somehow angrier.
I told you, Simon, I don't like the cold piece. I hate it, for your information. Not just for what it's doing to Helen and Aline, because it's wrong. But it's not like I have a better idea. This isn't about who you or I want to trust. This is about who the Clave can trust. You can't sign accords with leaders who refuse to be bound by their promises. You simply can't. If the Clave wanted revenge...
Isabel looked pointedly around the store, gaze resting on each weapon's display in turn.
Trust me, they could take it. The cold piece isn't just about the fair folk. It's about us. I may not like it, but I understand it. Better than you do, at least. If you'd been there, if you knew...
I was there, Simon said quietly. Remember?
Of course I do, but you don't. So it's not the same. You're not...
The same, he finished for her.
That's not what I meant. I just...
Trust me, Izzy. I get it. I'm not him. I'll never be him.
Isabel made a noise halfway between a hiss and a yowl.
Would you drop it already with this old Simon, new Simon inferiority complex? It's getting old.
Why don't you get a little creative and find a new excuse?
New excuse for what? He asked, genuinely confused.
For you not to be with me, she yelled. Because you're obviously looking for one. Try harder.
She stomped out of the store, slamming the door shut behind her. It dinged as it closed, and Not Diana emerged from the back.
Oh, it's still just you, he said, sounding distinctly disappointed. Have you decided?
Simon could give up right now. He could stop trying, stop fighting, just let her go. That would be the easiest of decisions. All he'd have to do would be to let it happen.
I decided a long time ago, Simon said, and ran out of the shop. He needed to find Isabel. It wasn't much of a challenge.
She was sitting on a small bench across the street, head in her hands. Simon sat down beside her.
"I'm sorry," he said quietly.
She shook her head without lifting it from her hands.
"I can't believe I was dumb enough to think this would work."
"It still can," he said with an embarrassing tinge of desperation.
"I still want it to, if you..."
"No, not you and me, idiot." She finally looked up at him. Mercifully, her eyes were dry. In fact, she didn't look sad at all. She looked furious.
"This stupid weapons shopping idea. Last time I take dating advice from Jace."
"You let Jace plan our date?" Simon said, incredulous.
"Well, it's not like either of us was doing a very good job of it. He took Clary here to buy a sword, and it was this whole disgustingly sexy thing, and I just thought maybe..."
Simon laughed in relief.
"I hate to break it to you, but you're not dating Jace."
Yeah, disgusting.
"No, I mean, you're not dating a guy who's anything like Jace."
"I wasn't aware I was dating anyone at all," she said, frost in her voice. His heart caught in his throat like it was snagged on barbed wire. But then, ever so slightly, she melted.
"Kidding, mostly."
"Relieved," he said, "mostly."
Isabel sighed.
"I'm sorry this was such a disaster.
It's not all your fault."
"Well, obviously it's not all my fault," she said. "Not even mostly my fault."
I thought we'd moved into the apologies portion of the day."
"Right, sorry."
He grinned.
"See, now you're talking."
"So what now? Back to the academy?"
"Are you kidding?"
Simon stood up and extended a hand to her. Miracle of miracles, she took it.
"We're not giving up until we get this right. But we're not going to get there pretending to be Jace and Clary. That's our whole problem, isn't it? Trying to be people we're not.
I can't be some kind of cool hipster nightclub hopper."
"I don't think there's any such thing as a nightclub hopper," Isabel said wryly.
"This proves my point. And you're never going to be some kind of gamer who wants to stay up all night debating Naruto plot points and battling D&D orcs."
"Now you're just making up words.
And neither of us is ever going to be Jace and Clary."
"Thank God," they said in sync, then exchanged a grin.
"So what are you suggesting?" Izzy asked.
"Something new," Simon said, mind racing to come up with an actual concrete, useful idea. He knew he was onto something. He just wasn't sure what.
"Not your world, not my world, a new world for just the two of us."
"Please tell me you don't want us to portal to some other dimension, because that didn't work out so well the last time."
Simon grinned, an idea dawning.
"Maybe we can find a spot slightly closer to home."
As the sun dipped beneath the horizon, the clouds overhead blushed cotton candy pink. The reflections gleamed on the crystalline waters of Lake Lynn. The horses whinnied, the birds chirped, and Simon and Isabel crunched their peanut brittle and popcorn. This, Simon thought, was the sound of happiness.
"You still haven't told me how you found this place," Isabel said. "It's perfect."
Simon didn't want to admit that it was John Cartwright who told him about the isolated inlet on the edge of Lake Lynn. Its hanging willows and rainbow of wildflowers making it the perfect spot for a romantic picnic. Even when the picnic consisted of peanut brittle, popcorn, and the handful of other random teeth-decaying, artery-clogging snacks they'd grabbed on their way out of Alicante. Simon, who had long ago grown tired of hearing about John's romantic exploits, had done his best to tune the jerk out. But apparently a few details had lodged in his subconscious, enough at least, to find the place. John Cartwright was a blowhard and a buffoon. Simon would maintain this to his dying day. But it turned out the guy had good taste in romantic date spots.
"Just stumbled on it," Simon mumbled. "Good luck, I guess."
Isabel gazed out at the impossibly smooth water.
"This place reminds me of Luke's farm," she said softly.
"Me too," he said. In that other life, the one he barely remembered, he and Clary had spent many long, happy days at Luke's summer house upstate, splashing in the lake, lying in the grass, naming the clouds. Isabel turned to him. Simon's jacket was spread out between them as an improvised picnic blanket. It was a small jacket, not very much distance for him to cross if he wanted to reach her. He'd never wanted anything more. I think about up there a lot, Izzy said. The farm, the lake.
Why?
Her voice softened. Because that was where I almost lost you. Where I was sure I would lose you. But I got you back. Simon didn't know what to say.
It doesn't even matter, she said, harder now. Not like you even know what I'm talking about.
I know what happened there.
Namely, Simon had summoned the angel Razia, and the angel had actually shown up. He wished he could remember it. He would like to know how that felt, talking to an angel.
Clary told you, she said flatly.
Yeah. Isabel was a little sensitive on the subject of Clary. She definitely didn't need to hear about all the time he'd had with Clary this summer. The long hours spent lying in Central Park, side by side, swapping stories of their past. Simon telling her what he remembered, Clary telling him what actually happened.
But she wasn't even there, Isabel said. She knows the important stuff.
Isabel shook her head. She reached across the picnic blanket and rested a hand on Simon's knee. He worked very hard to hear her over the sudden buzzing in his ears.
If she wasn't there, she can't know how brave you were, Isabel said. She can't know how scared I was for you. That's the important stuff.
There was silence between them then. But finally, it wasn't the awkward kind. It was the good kind. The kind where Simon could hear what Isabel was saying without her having to say it. And where he could answer her in kind.
What's it like? She asked him.
Not remembering. Being a blank slate. Her hand was still warm on his knee. She'd never asked him that before.
It's not quite a blank slate, he explained, or tried to. It's more like double vision. Like, I'm remembering two different things at the same time. Sometimes one seems more real, sometimes the other does. Sometimes everything is blurry. That's when I usually take some Advil and a nap.
But you're starting to remember things.
Some things, he allowed.
Jordan. I remember a lot about Jordan. Caring about him. Losing.
Simon swallowed hard.
Losing him.
I remember my mom freaking out about me being a vampire. And some stuff before Clary's mom got kidnapped. The two of us being friends before all of this started. Normal Brooklyn stuff.
He stopped talking as he realized her face was clouding over.
Of course you remember Clary.
It's not like that, he said.
Like what?
Simon didn't think about it. He just did it.
He took her hand.
She led him.
He wasn't sure how to explain this. It was still all jumbled in his head, but he had to try.
It's not like the things I remember are more important than the things I can't remember. Sometimes it seems like it's random. But sometimes, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like the most important things are going to be the hardest to get back. Picture all these memories buried, like dinosaur bones, and me trying to dig them up. Some of them are just lying right beneath the surface, but the important ones, those are miles down.
And you're saying that's where I am? Miles beneath the surface?
He held on to her tightly.
You're basically down there at the molten center of the earth.
You are so weird.
I try my best.
She threaded her fingers through his.
I'm jealous, you know, sometimes, that you can forget.
Are you kidding?
Simon couldn't even begin to understand that one.
Everything you have, all the people in your life, no one would want that taken away.
Isabel looked back out at the lake, blinking hard.
Sometimes people get taken away from you whether you want it or not. And sometimes, that hurts so much, it might be easier to forget.
She didn't have to say his name. Simon said it for her.
Max.
You remember him?
Simon had never realized what a sad sound it was. Hope.
He shook his head.
I wish I did, though.
Clary told you about him, she said.
Not a question.
And what happened to him?
He nodded, but her gaze was still fixed on the water.
He died in Idris, you know.
I like being here sometimes. I feel closer to him here.
Other times I wish this place would evaporate, that no one could ever come here again.
I'm sorry, Simon said, thinking they had to be the lamest, most useless words in the English language.
I wish I could say something that would help. She faced him. She whispered, You did.
What?
After Max, you said something. You helped.
Izzy.
Yes?
This was it. This was the moment. The moment talking gave way to gazing, which would inevitably give way to kissing. All he had to do was lean slightly forward and give himself over to it. He leaned back.
Maybe we should start heading back to campus.
She made that angry cat noise again, then lobbed a chunk of peanut brittle at him.
What is wrong with you? She exclaimed. Because I know there's nothing wrong with me. You would be insane not to want to kiss me, and if this is some stupid playing hard to get thing, you're wasting your time, because trust me, I know when a guy wants to kiss me. And you, Simon Lewis, want to kiss me. So what is happening here?
I don't know, he admitted. And ridiculous as this was, it was also wholly true.
Is it the stupid Mary thing? Are you seriously still afraid that you can't live up to some amazing forgotten version of yourself? Do you want me to tell you all the ways you weren't amazing? For one, you snored.
Did not.
Like a Dravac demon.
This is slander, Simon said, outraged.
She snorted. My point, Simon, is that you're supposed to be past all of this. I thought you figured out that no one is expecting you to be anyone other than who you are. That I just need you to be you. I only want you.
This, Simon.
Isn't that why we're here? Because you finally got that through your thick head?
I guess.
So what are you afraid of? It's obviously something.
How do you know?
He asked, curious how she could be so certain when he still had no clue himself.
She smiled, and it was the kind of smile you give to someone who can make you want to throttle them and kiss them all at the same time.
Because I know you.
He thought about gathering her up in his arms, about how it would feel. And that's when he realized what he was afraid of.
It was that feeling, the hugeness of it, like staring into the sun, like falling into the sun.
Losing myself, he said.
What?
That's what I'm afraid of. Losing myself in this, in you. I've spent this whole year trying to find myself, to figure out who I am, and now there's you. There's us. There's this all-consuming, terrifying black hole of a feeling. And if I give into it, I feel like I'm standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon, you know? Like, here's something bigger, deeper than the human mind is built to fathom. And I'm just supposed to jump in?
He waited nervously for her reaction, suspecting that girls probably didn't like it much when you admitted you were afraid of them. Girls like Izzy probably didn't like it when you admitted you were afraid of anything. Nothing scared her. She deserved someone just as brave.
Is that all?
Her face lit up.
Simon, don't you think I'm scared of that too? You're not the only one on that ledge. If we jump together. We fall together.
Simon has spent so long trying to gather together the pieces of himself to fit the puzzle back together. But the final piece, the most important piece, had been right in front of him the whole time. Losing himself to Izzy. Could it be that this was the only way to really find himself? Could it be that this, here, was home?
Enough bad metaphors, he told himself. Enough delaying. Enough being afraid.
He stopped thinking about the person he used to be, or the relationship they used to have. He stopped thinking about whether he was screwing things up, or why he wanted to. He stopped thinking about demon amnesia, and Shadowhunter ascension, and the fair folk, and the dark war, and politics, and homework, and the unregulated traffic of deadly sharp objects. He stopped thinking about what could happen and what could go wrong. He took her in his arms and kissed her. Kissed her the way he'd been longing to kiss her since he first laid eyes on her. Kissed her not like a romance novel hero or a Shadowhunter warrior or some imaginary character from the past, but like Simon Lewis kissing the girl he loved more than anything in the world. It was like falling into the sun. Falling together, hearts blazing with pale fire, and Simon knew he would never stop falling, knew that now that he'd grabbed hold of her again, he would never let go. The marriage of true minds admits no impediments, but the makeout sessions of teenagers all too often do. especially when one of the teenagers was a student at Shadowhunter Academy with both homework and a curfew, and when the other was a demon-fighting warrior with a stakeout in the morning. If Simon had had his way, he would have spent the next week, or possibly the next eternity, entangled with Izzy on the grass, listening to the lake lap against the shore, losing himself in the touch of her fingers and the taste of her lips. Instead, he spent a memorable 2 hours doing so, then galloped at breakneck speed back to Shadowhunter Academy and spent another hour kissing her goodbye, before letting her leap into the portal with a promise to return as soon as she could. He had to wait until the next day to thank Helen Blackthorne for her help. He caught her just as she was packing up to leave. "I see the date went well," she said, as soon as she opened the door.
"How could you tell?"
Helen smiled.
"You're practically radioactive."
Simon thanked her for relaying Izzy's message and handed her a small bag of cookies he'd caged from the dining hall. They were the only thing at the academy that actually tasted good.
"Consider this a small down payment on what I owe you," he said.
"You don't owe me anything, but if you really want to pay me back, come to the wedding. You can be Izzy's plus one."
"I wouldn't miss it," Simon promised.
"So when's the big day?"
1st of December, she said,
but there was a quavering note in her voice.
"Probably."
"Maybe sooner?"
"Maybe not at all," she admitted.
"What? You and Aline aren't breaking up?"
Simon caught himself, remembering that he was talking to someone he barely knew. He couldn't exactly command her to have a happy ending just because he's suddenly fallen in love with love.
"I'm sorry. It's none of my business, but why would you come all this way and take all their crap if you didn't want to marry her?"
"Oh, I want to marry her. More than anything. It's just, being back here has made me wonder if I'm being selfish."
"How could marrying Aline be selfish?" Simon asked.
"Look at my life!" Helen exploded. The days, or maybe the years, worth of pent-up fury blasting out of her. "They look at me like I'm some kind of freak show. And those are the kind ones. The ones who don't look at me like I'm the enemy. Aline is already stuck on that godforsaken island because of me. Is she supposed to suffer like that for the rest of her life? Just because she made the mistake of falling in love with me? What kind of person does that make me?"
"You can't possibly think any of this is your fault."
He didn't know her very well, but none of this sounded right to him. Not like something she would say or believe.
"Professor Mayhew told me that if I really loved her, I would leave her," Helen admitted, "instead of dragging her into this nightmare with me. That holding on to her is just proof that I'm more fairy than I think."
"Professor Mayhew is a troll," Simon said, and wondered what it would take to get Katarina Loss to turn him into one for real. Or maybe a toad. Or a lizard. Something that would more befit the reptilian nature of his soul.
"If you really loved Aline, you would do everything you can to hold on to her, which is exactly what you're doing. Besides, you're assuming that if you tried to break up with her for her own good, she'd let you. From what I've heard about Aline, that's not likely."
"No," Helen said fondly. "She'd fight me tooth and nail."
"Then why not fast forward to the inevitable? Accept that you're stuck with her, the love of your life. Poor you."
Helen sighed. "Isabel told me what you said about the Fae, Simon. About how you think it's wrong to discriminate against them. That fairies can be good just as much as anyone else." He didn't understand where she was going with this, but he wasn't sorry to have the chance to confirm it.
"She was right. I do think that."
"Isabel believes that too, you know," Helen said. "She's been doing her best to convince me."
"What do you mean?" Simon asked, confused. "Why would you need convincing?"
Helen kneaded her fingers together. "You know, I didn't want to come here to tell a bunch of kids the story of my mother and father. I didn't do that voluntarily. But I also didn't make it up. That's what happened. That's who my mother was, and that's what half of me is."
"No, Helen, that's not.
Do you know the poem, La Belle Dame Sans Merci?" Simon shook his head. The only poetry he knew was by Dr. Seuss or Bob Dylan.
"It's Keats," she said,
and recited a few stanzas for him by memory.
"She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed to feel sore. and there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses for. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamed, ah, woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamed on the cold hill's side. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death-pale were they all. They cried, La belle dame sans merci hath thee in thrall.
Keats wrote about fairies? Simon asked.
If they'd covered this in English class, he might have paid closer attention.
My father used to recite that poem all the time, Helen said. It was his way of telling me and Mark the story of where we came from.
He recited you a poem about an evil fairy queen luring men to their deaths as a way of telling you about your mother?
Repeatedly? Simon asked, incredulous.
No offense, but that's kind of harsh.
My father loved us despite where we came from, Helen said, in the way of someone trying to convince herself. But it always felt like he kept some part of himself in reserve. Like he was waiting to see her in me. It was different with Mark, because Mark was a boy. But girls take after their mothers, right?
I'm not really sure that's scientifically accurate logic, Simon said.
That's what Mark said. He always told me the fairies had no claim on us or our nature. And I tried to believe him, but then, after he was taken, after the Inquisitor told me the story of my birth mother, I wonder.
Helen was looking past Simon, past the walls of her domestic prison cell, lost in her own fears.
What if I'm luring Aline to that cold hill's side? What if that need to destroy, to use love as a weapon, is just hibernating in me somewhere, and I don't even know it? A gift from my mother.
Look, I don't know anything about fairies, Simon said. Not really. I don't know what the deal was with your mother, or what it means for you to be half one thing and half another. But I know your blood doesn't define you. What defines you is the choices you make. If I learned anything this year, it's that. And I also know that loving someone, even when it's scary, even when there are consequences, is never the wrong thing to do. Loving someone is the opposite of hurting her.
Helen smiled at him, her eyes brimming with unshed tears.
For both our sakes, Simon, I really hope that you're right.
In the land under the hill, in the time before. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful lady of the Seelie court who lost her heart to the son of an angel. Once upon a time, there were two boys come to the land of fairy, brothers noble and bold. One brother caught a glimpse of the fair lady, and thunderstruck by her beauty, pledged himself to her. Pledged himself to stay. This was the boy Andrew. His brother, the boy Arthur, would not leave his side. And so the boys stayed beneath the hill, and Andrew loved the lady, and Arthur despised her. And so the lady kept her boy close to her side, kept this beautiful creature who swore his fealty to her, and when her sister lay claim to the other, the lady let him be taken away, for he was nothing. She gave Andrew a silver chain to wear around his neck, a token of her love. And she taught him the ways of the fair folk. She danced with him in revels beneath starry skies. She fed him moonshine and showed him how to give way to the wild. Some nights they heard Arthur's screams, and she told them it was an animal in pain, and pain was in an animal's nature. She did not lie, for she could not lie. Humans are animals. Pain is their nature. For 7 years they lived in joy. She owned his heart, and he hers. And somewhere beyond, Arthur screamed and screamed. Andrew didn't know. The lady didn't care. And so they were happy. Until the day one brother discovered the truth of the other. The lady thought her lover would go mad with the grief of it and the guilt. And so, because she loved the boy, she wove him a story of deceitful truths. The story he would want to believe. That he had been ensorcelled to love her. That he had never betrayed his brother. That he was only a slave.
that these 7 years of love had been a lie. The lady set the useless brother free and allowed him to believe he had freed himself. The lady subjected herself to the useless brother's attack and allowed him to believe he had killed her. The lady let her lover renounce her and run away. And the lady beheld the secret fruits of their union and kissed them and tried to love them. But they were only a piece of her boy. She wanted all of him or none of him. As she had given him his story, she gave him his children. She had nothing left to live for then, and so lived no longer. This is the story she left behind, the story her lover will never know. This is the story her daughter will never know. This is how a fairy loves, with her whole body and soul. This is how a fairy loves, with destruction. "I love you," she told him, "night after night for 7 years. Fairies cannot lie," and he knew that. "I love you," he told her, "night after night for 7 years. Humans can lie," and so she let him believe he lied to her, and she let his brother and his children believe it. And she died hoping they would believe it forever. This is how a fairy loves, with a gift.
Bitter of Tongue. Read by Torrance Coombs.
The sun was shining, the birds were singing, and it was a beautiful day at Shadowhunter Academy. Well, Simon was pretty sure the sun was shining. There was a faint luminescence to the air in his and George's underground chamber, casting a pleasant glow upon the green slime that coated their walls. And all right, he could not hear the birds from his subterranean room, but George did come back from the showers singing.
"Good morning, Si. I saw a rat in the bathroom, but he was taking a nice nap and we didn't bother each other."
"Or the rat was dead of a very infectious disease which has now been introduced to our water system," Simon suggested. "We may be drinking plague rat water for weeks."
"Nobody likes a gloomy Gus," George scolded him. "Nobody likes a sullen Si. Nobody's here for a moody Mildred. No one fancies it."
"I have gathered the general tenor of your discourse, George," said Simon. "I object strongly to being referred to as a moody Mildred, especially as I really feel like I'm a mildly good-humored Mildred right now. I see you're looking forward to your big day."
"Have a shower, Si," George urged. "Start the day refreshed. Maybe style your hair a little. It wouldn't kill you."
Simon shook his head. "There's a dead rat in the bathroom, George. I am not going in the bathroom, George."
"Well, he's not dead," George said. "He's just sleeping. I'm certain of it."
"Senseless optimism is how plagues get started," Simon said. "Ask the medieval peasants of Europe." "Oh, wait, you can't."
"Oh, were they a jolly bunch?" George asked skeptically.
"I'm sure they were much jollier before all the plague," said Simon. He felt he was making really good points, and that he was backed up by history. He pulled off the shirt he'd slept in, which read, "Let's fight," and below in tiny letters, "Our enemy off with cunning arguments." George whipped Simon's back with his wet towel, which made Simon yelp. Simon grinned as he pulled his gear out of their wardrobe. They were getting started right after breakfast, so he might as well change into gear straight off. Plus, every day wearing gear made for men was a victory. He and George went up to breakfast in good humor with all the world.
"You know, this porridge isn't at all bad," Simon said, digging in.
George nodded enthusiastically, his mouth full. Beatrice looked sad for them, and possibly sad that boys were so stupid in general.
"This isn't porridge," she told them. "These are scrambled eggs."
"Oh, no,"
George whispered faintly, his mouth still full, his voice terribly sad.
"Oh, no."
Simon dropped his spoon and stared into the depths of his bowl with horror. If they are scrambled eggs, he asked. And I'm not arguing with you, Beatrice. I'm just asking what I feel is a very reasonable question. If they are scrambled eggs, why are they gray? Beatrice shrugged and continued eating, carefully avoiding the lumps. Who can say? That could be made into a sad song, Simon supposed. If they are eggs, why are they gray? Who can say? Who can say? He found himself still thinking of song lyrics sometimes, even though he was out of the band. Admittedly, Why Are the Eggs So Gray might not be a big hit even on the hipster circuit. Julie plopped her bowl down on the table beside Beatrice. The eggs are gray, she announced. I don't know how they do this. Surely, at this point, it would actually make sense for them not to mess up the food sometimes? Every time, every day, for over a year? Is the Academy cursed?
I have been thinking it might be, George said earnestly. I hear an eldritch rattling sometimes like ghosts shaking the terrible chains. Honestly, I was hoping the Academy was cursed, since otherwise it's probably creatures in the pipes.
George shuddered.
Creatures.
Julie sat down. George and Simon exchanged a private, pleased look. They had been keeping track of how often Julie chose to sit with the three of them, rather than with John Cartwright. Currently, they were winning 60% to 40%. Julie choosing to sit with them seemed like a good sign, since this was George's big day. Now that they were Shadowhunter trainees in their second year, and, in the words of Scarsbury,
no longer totally hopeless and liable to cut off your own stupid heads,
they were given their own slightly more important missions. Every mission had an appointed team leader, and the team leader got double points if the mission was a success. Julie, Beatrice, Simon, and John had already been team leaders, and they had killed it. Everyone's mission accomplished, demons slain, people saved, downworlders breaking the law penalized severely but fairly. In some ways it was a pity that John's mission had gone so well, as he had bragged about it for weeks, but they couldn't help it. They were just too good, Simon thought, even as he slapped the wooden table so as not to jinx himself. There was no way for them to fail. Feeling nervous, team leader? Asked Julie. Simon had to admit she could sometimes be an unsettling companion.
No, said George, and under Julie's gimlet eye. Maybe. Yes. You know, an appropriate amount of nervous but in a cool, collected and good under pressure way.
Don't go all to pieces, said Julie. I want a perfect score.
An awkward silence followed. Simon comforted himself by looking over at John's table. When Julie abandoned him, John had to eat all alone, unless Marisol decided she wanted to sit with him and torment him, which, Simon noted, she was doing today. Little devil. Marisol was hilarious. John made urgent gestures for help, but Julie had her back turned to him and did not see.
I'm not saying this to scare you, George, she said.
That's a side benefit, obviously.
This is an important mission. You know fairies are the worst kind of downworlder. Fairies crossing over into the mundane realm and tricking the poor things into eating fairy fruit is no joke. Mundanes can wither away and die after eating that fruit, you know. It's murder, and it's murder we can hardly ever get them for, because by the time the mundanes die, the fairies are long gone. You're taking this seriously, right?
Yes, Julie, said George. I actually do know murder is bad, Julie.
Julie's whole face pursed up in that alarming way it did sometimes.
Remember, it was you who almost screwed up my mission.
I hesitated slightly to tackle that vampire child, George admitted.
Precisely, said Julie. No more hesitation. As our team leader, you have to act on your own initiative.
I'm not saying you're bad, George. I'm saying you need to learn.
I'm not sure anybody needs this kind of motivational speech, Beatrice said. It would freak anyone out. It's too easy to freak George out as it is. George, who had been looking touched at Beatrice's gallant defense, stopped looking touched.
I just think they should do a repeat team leader occasionally, Julie grumbled, letting them know where all this hostility was coming from.
She stabbed her gray eggs wistfully.
I was so good.
Simon raised his eyebrows.
You had a horsewhip and threatened to beat me about the head and face if I didn't do what you said.
Julie pointed her spoon at him.
Exactly. And you did what I said. That's leadership, that is. What's more, I didn't beat you about the head and face. Kind,
but firm. That's me. Julie discussed her own greatness at some length. Simon got up to get another glass of juice.
What kind of juice do you think this is?
Katerina Loss asked, joining him in the line.
Fruit? Said Simon. Just fruit. It's all they would tell me. I found it suspicious as well.
I like fruit,
Katerina said, but she did not sound sure about that.
I know you're excused from my class this afternoon. What are you up to this morning?
A mission to stop fairies from slipping over their borders and engaging in illicit trade, Simon said. George is team leader.
George is team leader? Katerina asked.
Hmm. Why is everyone so down on George today? Simon demanded. What's wrong with George? There's nothing wrong with George. It is not possible to find fault with George. He's a perfect Scottish angel. He always shares the snacks that his mother sends him, and he's better looking than Jace. There, I said it. I'm not taking it back.
I see you're in the good mood, said Katerina. All right, then. Go on, have a good time. Take care of my favorite student.
Right, said Simon. Wait, who's that? Katerina gestured him away from her with her indeterminate juice. Get lost, Daylighter. Everyone else was excited to go on another mission. Simon was looking forward to it as well, and pleased for George's sake. But Simon was mostly excited, because after the mission, he had somewhere else to be. The fair folk had been seen last on a moor in Devon. Simon was a bit excited to portal there and hoped there would be time to see red postboxes and drink lager at an English pub. Instead, the moor turned out to be a huge stretch of uneven field, rocks, and hills in the distance. No red postboxes or quaint pubs in sight. They were immediately given horses by the contact with the site, who was waiting for them. Lots of fields, lots of horses. Simon was not sure why they'd bothered to leave the academy, because this was an identical experience. The first words George said as they were riding on the moor were,
I think it would be a good idea to split up.
Like in a horror movie? Simon asked. Julie, Beatrice, and John gave him looks of irritated incomprehension. Marisol's uncertain expression suggested she agreed with Simon, but she did not speak up, and Simon didn't want to be the one mutinying against his friend's leadership. They would cover more if they split up. Maybe it was a great idea. More. How could it go wrong? I'll be partners with John, Marisol said instantly, a glint in her dark eyes. I wish to continue our conversation from breakfast. I have many more things to say to him on the subject of video games.
I don't want to hear any more about video games, Marisol, snapped John, a shadow hunter in a nightmare of torrential mundane information.
Marisol smiled. I know. Marisol had only just turned 15. Simon was not sure how she'd worked out that telling John every detail about the mundane world would be such effective psychological terrorism. Her evil had only grown in the year and change Simon had known her. Simon had to respect that.
And Sai and I will be together, George said easily.
Said Simon. Neither he nor George was a shadow hunter yet, and though Katerina helped them see through glamours, no mundane, or non-shadow hunter, was as securely protected from fairy glamour as one of the Nephilim. But Simon didn't want to question George's authority or suggest he didn't want to be partners. He was also scared of being partnered with Julie and beaten about the head and face.
Great,
Simon finished weakly. Maybe we can split up but also stay within hearing range of each other?
You want to split up but stay together? John asked. Do you not know what words mean?
Do you know what the words World of Warcraft mean? Asked Marisol menacingly.
Yes, I do, said John. All put together in that way, no, I do not, and I do not wish to.
He urged his horse onward across the moor. Marisol followed in pursuit. Simon stared at the back of John's head and worried he would go too far. Except that they were meant to be splitting up. This was all right. George gazed around at the remaining members of the team and appeared to come to a decision.
We'll stay within hearing range of each other, and comb over the moors, see if we can see the fair folk in any of the places they were reported lurking. Are you with me, team?
I'm with you to the end, if it doesn't take too long. You know I'm going to Helen Blackthorn and Aline Penhallow's wedding, said Simon.
Ah, hate weddings, said George sympathetically. You have to wear a monkey suit and go sit around for ages while everybody secretly hates each other over some fight about the flower arrangements. Plus, bagpipes. I mean, I don't know how Shadowhunter weddings go. Are there flowers? Are there bagpipes?
Can't talk right now, said Beatrice, picturing Jace Herondale in a tuxedo. In my head, he looks like a beautiful spy.
James Bond,
George contributed.
James Blonde?
I still don't like monkey suits.
But it doesn't seem like you mind, Si.
Simon lifted a hand from the reins to point proudly to himself, a maneuver that would have had him falling off his horse a year ago. This monkey is going as Isabel Lightwood's date. Just saying the words suffused Simon with a sense of well-being. In such a wonderful world, how could anything go wrong? He looked around at his team, the whole lot of them, wearing long-sleeved gear against the winter chill, figures in black, with bows strapped to their backs and their breath, white plumes in the cold air, riding fast horses through the moors on a mission to protect humankind. His three friends by his side, John and Marisol in the distance. George, so proud to be team leader. Marisol, scornful city kid, riding her horse with easy grace. Even Beatrice and Julie, even John, born Shadowhunters all, looked a little different to Simon, now that they were well into their second year at the academy. Scarsbury had honed them, Katerina had lectured them, and even their fellow academy students had changed them. And now the born Shadowhunters rode with mundanes and performed missions with them as a unit, and the so-called dregs could keep up. The moor was rolling green, tree-lined to their left, all quivering leaves as if the trees were dancing in the slight breeze. The sunlight was pale and clear, shining on their heads and their black clothes alike. Simon found himself thinking, with affection and pride, that they looked like they might make real Shadowhunters after all. He noticed that by silent mutual agreement, Beatrice and Julie were coaxing their mounts on faster. Simon squinted up into the distance where he could just about still make out John and Marisol, and then squinted at Beatrice and Julie's backs. He felt again that pang of uneasiness. "Why are they all racing ahead?" Simon asked. "Not to tell you your job, but, brave team leader, maybe command them not to go too far?"
"Ach, give them a minute," George said. "You know she kind of likes you."
"What?" said Simon.
"Not that she's going to do anything about it," said George. "Nobody who likes is going to do anything about it, on account of nobody would enjoy having Isabel Lightwood cut their head off."
"Likes me?" Simon echoed. "Something about the way you're talking suggests multiple people who like me." George shrugged.
"Yeah, apparently you're the type who grows on people. Don't ask me, I thought girls liked abs."
"I could have abs," Simon told him. "I watched in the mirror once, and I think I found an ab. I'm telling you, all this training is doing my body good." It wasn't like Simon thought he was a hideous creature or anything. He'd now seen several demons who had tentacles coming out of their eyes, and he was fairly sure it did not revolt people merely to look upon him. But he wasn't Jace, who made girls' heads spin around as if they were possessed. It made no sense that out of all the students in the academy, Beatrice might like him. George rolled his eyes. George did not truly understand the slow development of actual physical fitness. He'd probably been born with abs. Some were born with abs, some achieved abs, and some, like Simon, had abs thrust upon them by cruel instructors.
"Yeah, Si, you're a real killer."
"Feel this arm," said Simon. "Rock hard. I don't mean to brag, but it's all bone. All bone."
"Si," said George, "I don't need to feel it. I believe in you, because that's what bros do. And I'm happy for your mysterious popularity with the ladies, because that's how bros are. But seriously, watch out for John, because I think he's going to shank you one of these days. He does not get your indefinable but undeniable allure. He's got abs to the chin, and he thought he had the ladies of the academy locked down."
Simon rode on, somewhat dazed. He'd been thinking that Isabel's affection for him was a stunning and inexplicable occurrence, like a lightning strike. Gorgeous and courageous lightning whom he was lucky to be struck by. Given current evidence, however, he was starting to believe it was time to reevaluate. He had been reliably informed that he dated Maya,
the leader of the New York werewolf pack, though he'd received the impression that he had well and truly messed that one up. He'd heard rumors about a vampire queen who might have been interested. He'd even gathered